Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Jurisdiction and Comparison of CTP Schemes Around the Globe. Exciting. So two presenters today are Peter McCarthy and Lisa Moran. I'm Jazz, I'm chairing, and we'll have a Q&A session after the presentation, and either I or somebody will be bringing the microphone, and you can ask a question. Just a brief background on Peter. Peter has spent over 30 years working with personal injury schemes all around Australia, in every jurisdiction almost. He spent 9 years working in large general insurer, which includes management of large personal injury portfolio, including claims management. He has advised a variety of clients, including governments, insurers, self-insurers, reinsurance, and corporates on personal injury matters in New South Wales, Queensland, South Australia, WA, Victoria, Tasmania, NT and the ACT. I think that's the whole of Australia. Peter has been involved in a number of personal injury scheme reviews, both from the insurer perspective and also as an advisor to the government. Peter has was the actuarial advisor to the New South Wales government on their recent CTP reforms and is currently supporting the ACT government in deliberative democracy process to review the CTP scheme. He was also on the New South Wales CTP and Workers' Comp Scheme Actuary to Workers' Comp Scheme Actuary to CIRA. In 2017, Peter also led the CTP reform project component of EY's independent review for the government of BC in Canada and the monopoly insurer ICBC. So Peter's more than well qualified for this session. Lisa has over 10 years experience. She asked me not to say that, makes it look old, but I'll just say over 10 years experience across consulting and corporate roles in the UK and Australia. Lisa had a significant role in the costing of scheme benefit designs for the recent CTP reforms in New South Wales and developed specialist knowledge of the TAC scheme benefits. Lisa continues to support CIRA in relation to guidelines, regulation and other processes relevant to the new CTP scheme. Lisa is also supporting the ACT government in developing costings for alternative benefit designs for the CTP scheme as part of the current deliberative democracy review process. Earlier this year, Lisa also spent several months in Canada enjoying the CTP reform component of EY's independent review of ICBC, the monopoly government insurer for the province of BC. So I'll ask these two to take it from here.
Thank you. I just wanted to point that there's a number of Canadian and US co-authors here listed below. We were actually just part of a bigger team. And the review actually also included road safety. So we're actually going to talk a bit about road safety, which I must admit we didn't do any of this work ourselves, but the results are actually really quite interesting. So as part of the job we were doing, we were asked to compare contrast schemes across the globe and identify best in class across the following areas: coverage and benefits, affordability, road safety, claims experience, fraud and exaggerated claims. So EY was selected to do this, and Lisa and I became involved in this because the British Columbia government and the Insurance Corporation of British Columbia were actually really interested in what was going on in Australia and specifically New South Wales. The British Columbia scheme was facing serious challenges. There were been an increase in accidents of about 23%. Since 2012, which has actually resulted in about 28% increase in claim numbers, which is actually quite different to what we see in Australia, where the number of casualties and therefore in theory the number of claims has been going down. They've had a significant rise in number and size of minor injury claims, and the premiums were the second highest in Canada, yet insufficient to cover claims. Sounds all very familiar. So the content for the report was based primarily on publicly available information. And I guess the issue with that is that it's always very difficult to have, to make sure the comparisons are on a like-with-like basis with other countries. So I'm sure there's some issues around definitions in trying to actually understand and come up with the metrics for these comparisons. So it's possible that some metrics in some countries are not on a totally like-with-like basis with British Columbia. In addition, because we're only part of this broader team from the US and Canada, we probably may not be able to answer some of the detailed questions, particularly around product design. So the schemes in particular we looked at in Australia was New South Wales, Queensland and Victoria. The Canadian people were very interested in Victorian and their road safety initiatives. We looked at the Canadian provinces, and there are big variations in those provinces in premiums and also design. We looked at selected US states, UK, and to some extent New Zealand. Now, in this presentation, we're not actually going to go through the Australian-New Zealand schemes. We think most people have a pretty good idea about those, but not about the other schemes overseas. So Lisa's going to take us through the product coverage and look at the difference between the various schemes, and I'll come back and talk about other aspects.
Thanks, Peter. So, as we mentioned, we spent a lot of time looking at Canadian provinces being the most most relevant, and there's a wide variety of underwriting models, most of which have been reformed in the last 10 to 20 years. But British Columbia has not changed since the scheme was incepted in 1973. So just a brief introduction to CTP or auto insurance in Canada. Like here, most provinces require proof of insurance before the vehicle is registered, and there are different types of models, fully public, both no fault in a couple of provinces, and then fully common law, like in British Columbia, privately underwritten, and there's also a choice type model where you can choose a no fault product or a common law product, which is interesting. And in fact, most people, the default is the no-fault product, and vast majority of people stick with that. Very few take up the common law option. So mandatory coverage falls under several types. So most provinces have a certain amount of accident benefits or statutory benefits. The amounts vary widely, so some are very generous, particularly after reform. Some of the regions like Ontario, extremely generous benefits, and others, like in British Columbia, for example, are really inadequate. Which brings us to the third-party liability, or the right to sue. So fault-based model, sue common law, and the minimum mandatory coverage is usually about 200K. Canadian dollars, but there's optional top-ups, so you can choose to get additional coverage, and most policyholders do. On top of that, there are optional coverages, which are actually underwritten privately. So the monopoly government insurer writes these coverages as well, and in fact they have, I think, 70 or 80% of the market, but then other private insurers write some of these coverages as well. So it's a competitive market. So things like collision cover, fire, theft, and comprehensive plans. So as an example, we'll just talk through the basic auto plan, which is the mandatory product or the CTP equivalent in British Columbia. So it provides both no-fault accident benefits, which are really quite low, and then there's a fault-based common law with the minimum limited to 200K, but as I said, you can purchase extra coverage. So there's third-party liability, up to $1 million there for commercial, otherwise 200K for personal, and accident benefits. And as you can see, these are really, really quite low. The medical costs, the medical benefits haven't been updated since 1991, so they're limited at $150,000 per person. And when you think of the cost of medical care, particularly in somewhere like Canada, which has excellent medical, that is really, really inadequate. Wage losses are up to a maximum of $300 per week. So in comparison to some of the benefits we get in Australia, it's really, really quite different. And some could argue that that might be causing a little bit of, might be an incentive to be putting in some of the big, big claims we see at common law. There are other coverages in the basic auto plan, so things like underinsured motorist, hit and run damage, and inverse liability, or basically interstate kind of cover. And then, as I mentioned, there's an optional coverage where you can purchase additional covers, and obviously you pay a lot for that. And we'll come to the affordability section shortly, where it's actually amazing how much some people pay for their basic motor insurance premium. In the US, we looked at a few select states. Again, wide variety of models in the US. So all states require motor vehicle owners to have insurance, although there is quite a high proportion of uninsured drivers in some states, particularly in the southern states of the US. It's more than 20% of drivers are driving without insurance. And part of that is the affordability issue. So the state schemes can be privately or publicly underwritten, or a combination. The coverages are often expressed as like a 20-40-10. So it's easy to compare coverages by state, by insurer, and basically it's breaking down the protection of $20,000 per person up to a max of 40. And in this case, the $10,000 refers to the property damage of the car. Similar to Canada, there's no-fault coverage, or there's statutory benefits for all claimants, regardless of fault, and limits vary very widely. And that's available in most states, but not all. Most of those jurisdictions that do have no-fault benefits use different thresholds for accessing general damages or non-economic loss at common law. And there's quite a lot that have a verbal or a qualitative threshold, which is interesting, and others have a quantitative threshold. So we didn't dig into how effective these thresholds are, but just to make the point that this is a common way of differentiating access to pain and suffering at common law in the US. As an example, we look at Pennsylvania briefly. It's an uncommon model in the US in that it's a choice, no fault. So the default is no fault benefits, but drivers can choose to purchase a full tort plan or a limited tort plan. So in other words, they can get non-economic loss at common law if they have an accident, if they're paying for the full tort plan. And then the limited tort depends on if the injury is serious or not. So again, we didn't delve into the detail, but it was an interesting model in comparison to what we have here. So the key benefits here, there's a minimum limit of $5,000 with the default no-fault model for medical, and you can purchase higher limits. At common law, it's higher premium, really obviously, and if you're paying for that plan, then you can make a claim for any injury. And as I said, with the limited one, it depends on the definition of serious injury. Massachusetts is privately underwritten and is a pure no-fault model. I think this is one of the more generous states. They have a modified comparative fault. It's basically the contributory negligence applies to the benefits, so they're reduced if you're deemed to be somewhat at fault. And the coverage is basically third-party bodily injury and property damage available at common law. and personal injury protection, which is similar to the no-fault benefits in other states, so things like medical, loss of income, etc., regardless of fault. UK, just briefly, was another jurisdiction with fully common law, unlimited, but in respect to whiplash, you might be familiar with the whiplash reforms that are proposed for next year. So it's a very similar theme to what we're seeing in Australia and in Canada, that these minor soft tissue whiplash claims are causing claim frequency and cost to rise. So the UK are bringing in whiplash reform there, where the benefits will be restricted and limited to a schedule. Uninsured drivers are covered by a levy on premiums. And also a recent change is that currently the insurance isn't compulsory for off-road vehicles, but that is actually contradicting an EU first directive, which is saying that it should cover all vehicles. So that's currently under review. So just to summarise the benefits, so all benefits are negotiated at common law. There's no real statutory benefits component. The Jackson reforms, which came in a few years ago, established an online fast-track process for small claims, trying to reduce the cost of that common law process, especially for the minor claims. But as I mentioned, the whiplash claims are really causing cost to rise. So those reforms are coming in 2018, where there'll be capped damages according to a fixed schedule. Nothing else of note there. And I think, do you want to talk about premiums?
So affordability of premiums. As in Australia, it's a big driver of reform in Canada and other countries. Interesting thing, I think, in Canada and also US, there at some schemes, at some points in time, a lot of uninsured vehicles. It can be as much as 20%, and the history in Canada is that some schemes, when they get up, when premiums actually increase quite a lot, the proportion of uninsured vehicles becomes quite high and can be 20% in some years. There's very few, or quite limited number of uninsured vehicles in Australia. And as you'll see from the next chart, Australia and New Zealand CDP schemes look pretty affordable compared to some of the overseas countries. So I might use this little...
Not work.
So over here, you've got some of the some of the Canadian and US schemes, and you can see that the premiums are about 100% or more of average weekly earnings. At a British Columbia, it's about 100%. And you go down and see how expensive the premiums are overseas compared to some of the Australian schemes, where they're actually quite cheap. This was actually a bit of a surprise to me, actually. I didn't realise that some of the schemes overseas were so expensive. And in British Columbia, when you actually combine the your physical damage premium as well, you're looking at $1,500, $2,000 on average per vehicle to insure, in addition to, I guess, there's a registration fee to apply. So with many households having 2-3 cars, that's a pretty big expense. Mind you, when the average weekly earnings in British Columbia is only about $50,000 compared to about $75,000 in Australia. One of the really interesting aspects of this work that was done, and Lisa and I didn't do this, we actually saw the results, it was done by other parts of our team, was around road safety. And I found this really quite insightful and something I wasn't aware of, but maybe I should have been, is when you actually look at the accident rates per 100,000 people over a period of about 10 years, and there were 22 in this survey, 22 schemes or states or provinces, and we ranked them from 1 to 22. And you can see some of them are actually quite high. I think these two actually have very sparse populations. But Australia looks pretty good, actually. You know, 3, 4, 5 out of 22. It's pretty good. And then if we go to the next slide, which looks at fatality rates, Australia looks pretty good as well compared to all these other states. Some of them actually really look quite poor. So when our guys in Canada looked into this, they found some really interesting stuff about road safety. And they were particularly interested in Victoria as a bit of a role model around road safety. And this is an example. In British Columbia, they have 140 fixed cameras, but most of the time they're actually turned off. They're not actually operating. Very effective road safety, or ineffective. And our guys contrasted this with Victoria and found Victoria had 280 fixed and 1,750 mobile cameras, whereas British Columbia had no mobile cameras. And it's a very big, very big difference in the road safety. I actually, when we were over there, I was talking to some of the EY guys and I said, I think it's a cultural thing around road safety. Australians have been so ingrained to think road safety for decades and decades. Whereas what struck me is in British Columbia, they didn't have that culture. The government actually seemed to be criticised if they actually wanted to introduce things, initiatives around road safety, like the fixed cameras. Apparently there was a court case around these, which meant that as a result, they weren't turned on very often. So, as part of this, our guys actually looked at what was happening with road safety in other jurisdictions. And I guess the message here is this is what British Columbia was not doing and what other jurisdictions were doing around road safety. And you go down the list and the result is British Columbia are not really doing anywhere near as much around road safety as the Australian states. It was actually quite interesting. So they've got a long way to catch up. And I suspect, but I don't know, that this actually is also a function of other provinces in Canada. They don't do anywhere near as much around road safety. It came home to me how important road safety is around these schemes and why I think in a way, you know, Victoria and other states in Australia can, you know, take a lot of kudos from the work that government's done around road safety in Australia. So reform in Canada, over the past 20 years, almost every province in Canada has been through a reform of their CDP scheme. In every single case, the driver was an increase in minor severity claims or minor injury claims and an increase in the average size of damages paid to these minor claims. So all of them went for a purely sort of common law fault-based scheme and changed their design in a variety of different ways. And you can see this is just a chart in British Columbia, average pain and suffering, non-economic loss. And you can see for the minor injuries, how much the average size has increased for the minor severity claims compared to the non-minor, which has actually been, in the recent years, pretty stable. One of the things we observe in Canada, and we've actually got quite a few more states, what happened after the reforms were implemented is that there seemed to be, I wouldn't say all states, but most of the provinces, a significant decrease in claims frequency after the reforms. And these are just two examples. And I actually put this down to a behavioural impact from implementation of reforms. And there are plenty of examples where this has happened in Australia. And we see New South Wales, this is more of a behaviour of lawyers. In New South Wales, about a year ago, they introduced restrictions. They put a cap on legal costs for claims up to $50,000 so that lawyers didn't get anywhere near as much money. And guess what happened to claims frequency? It was a significant decrease for minor injury claims. That's a behaviour issue. There was no change to the entitlement of for claimants. This is average claim size. The thing that struck me is the average claim size of claims in the overseas jurisdiction seems to be a lot lower. On the other hand, and I still can't get my head around this, the claims frequency in British Columbia was 5 times the level of New South Wales. It was actually, I still can't figure out why it's so high. However, I do know the Operation Ravens that New South Wales government put in place around CDP fraud. One of the senior guys in that task force actually won an international award for around financial fraud, and he had to go to Vancouver to receive the award. And when the Vancouver Police Department found out, they actually wanted to talk to him. My personal view is there's actually probably lots of fraud going on in Vancouver, but they're really not doing very much about it. So on average claim size, you can see there's quite a big difference. So I've already touched on this. I think the British Columbia government was actually quite interested in New South Wales to the extent that for the ICBC, the Insurance Corporation of British Columbia, they wanted to actually understand what was going on in New South Wales in more detail, so we set up a video conference between the ICBC board and CIRA in New South Wales. And they actually found it quite interesting around the challenges around reform and vested stakeholders or service providers. And they actually learnt a new phrase, which was a burning platform. It was actually quite interesting. The board, I didn't realise this until after, there was this side conversation between the chairman of the board and our EY Canadian people about, what's burning platform mean? What's burning platform? So you will have seen a lot of the media coverage around the New South Wales fraud. It's interesting, as being part of the ACT process, the guy who went to Canada actually to receive the award came down and presented to the citizens jury, 50 citizens of ACT, and he had no vested interest in this scheme, no real interest. So he told it as it was, and it was actually quite insightful around the driving force that lump sums have around people's behaviour, around fraud. I'll just finish off with two little examples. While we're over there, one of the EY Canadian team sent us this judgment from a court case on a C2P claim in British Columbia. And his comment was, no wonder the cost of claims are so high. Apparently, just paraphrasing what actually happened, is that a judge actually made a ruling that to be accepted that you had a psychological injury, you didn't have to provide any medical evidence. It was sufficient for your, if you got testimony from your friends or whoever, that your behaviour had changed significantly since you had the accident. Isn't that an open slather for lots more claims? The other really interesting thing I found was that there's a whole industry build-up around the ability to go to common law to sue the at-fault driver for a loss in the value of your vehicle as arising from the accident. It's the whole industry. built around this. And so I was actually quite fascinated that, you know, in Australia we sometimes find that we get really interesting judgments, but I think these two were actually really fascinating case studies of how extreme you can get in some of these common law schemes. So I guess in conclusion, we actually found this a really interesting study looking at some of the other schemes around the world. There is a really wide variety of product types of benefits available. I struggled to see how some of them actually really work in practice. The board of ICBC was actually quite interested in getting us to actually think about providing choice, but there are examples where choice of product is available in Canada and US and the take-up is very, very low. Minor injuries is such a common theme across all these schemes. It's the blowout in the number and cost of minor injuries which causes cost pressures and need for reform. And it's exactly the same as happened in Australia. Over many years, the same thing happens time and time again. there's a huge range of affordability. I mean, we may complain about high premiums in Australia, but it's interesting that it's a lot more expensive overseas. The interesting thing around a lot of these schemes, they do have thresholds, verbal and dollar ones. We haven't looked into how successful they are. I sort of have reservations whether they really contain costs or not. The other interesting thing is what we realised, found out, is that New South Wales has introduced this definition of minor injury, and at least three Canadian schemes have a similar definition to New South Wales. And it seems to me, even though we didn't look at this detail, that they did seem to work, at least over a relatively short period of maybe 5-10 years. And I guess the big thing I found about this whole thing is how important road safety is and how far advanced Australia is around road safety compared to what I expected Canada and the US would be, and UK around road safety. They seem to be behind Australia. And the report is public, and there's a link to the website where you can find the report. It's about 400 pages.
I think we have about 7-8 minutes for questions. What I'll do is I'll bring the microphone around to anybody interested in asking a question, and please feel free.
Peter, it's a long time since I looked at it, but as I understood in the US, the reason for the low claims costs is the settlements always occur within the insurance limits, and the insurance limits in a lot of these states are very low. I don't know if you have any information on that, but that's my understanding of what happened. Because the plaintiff lawyers don't see any advantage in pursuing people beyond the insurance limits, unless you're really rich.
That's, it's quite plausible, but we didn't look at that. I guess one thing we did notice in British Columbia is with common law, a lot of people only purchase $1 or $2 million in cover. I actually don't know what happens when a claim exceeded like the $1 or $2 million, what actually happened, whether they actually did pursue the at-fault driver or not. It's the same thing in the US. That probably limits.
I've never looked at it either, but I think there's also issues in the personal bankruptcy laws in the US, which are somewhat different to what we have here.
Yeah.
And therefore the advantages of pursuing people for tort claims is not nearly as great.
Mm.
And it just demonstrates that you can actually bring about a form of regulation by saying, well, the policy will only cover you up to X. And then you've got to pay real money to buy the rest.
It'd be interesting if that was tried in Australia. Although I must admit, in CDP, you actually don't need that now, only because of the NDIS and NIIS.
Hi, Rick Howe from the Insurance Commission in WA. Just a quick one. You had obviously those price comparisons up with all jurisdictions. To what extent has that separated out what the key benefits are? Because obviously some of the standard insurance in other jurisdictions includes property damage and things like that, whereas here, of course, it's a very separate piece. So is it close enough to apples and apples, or are we looking at apples, oranges and pears up there?
It's kind of more like apples and oranges and pears, but we have separated out property damage. So it's really just the bodily injury component. But yes, it is apples and oranges, but it's the average price that somebody has to pay for their mandatory insurance in that jurisdiction. Yeah.
Hi. Did you compare the schemes based on anything other than financial information, such as customer satisfaction or even referencing this morning's plenary session around client outcomes or even that sort of thing?
No.
Do you have a, I don't know, can you, do you have an opinion about or have any insights from the in that vein?
Well, I could make one comment around British Columbia. The fact that the no-fault accident benefits are up to $300 loss of wages maximum has not been changed in many years. I would have thought actually leads to a fair bit of dissatisfaction. I don't know. And I comment to our guys in Canada, my view that that was actually forcing people to go to common law because they were out of pocket for all these medical expenses and their loss of wages. It has to be forcing people to go to common law.
There's one example of a state that's tried to bring in early treatment and generous no-fault benefits is Ontario, and they've made an absolute mess of it. It's horribly complicated, so people are hiring lawyers just to get through it. It's costing more than ever before. And, yeah, so the aim was all these treatment plans, but they just have made it overly complex, and, yeah, it's not working.
Okay, I think we have time for one brief question. Any takers?
Just wondering, was there any consideration given to comparisons against any of the schemes across Asia?
No.
quick question.
The ICBC actually wanted US, Canadian, Australian. We thought they should add New Zealand, Europe, UK, and they actually put South Africa. I can't actually remember the reason why Europe, excluding UK, and South Africa didn't actually make our report.
We didn't get around to it.
We had limited time.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you. Could you please join me in thanking Peter and Lisa? And we have a little gift for both of them.